Hi, everybody. This is Joanne Manister with Read Science, and I'm joined today by, of course, my host, Jeff Schomeyer, where we like to bring in guests and talk to them about the books they've written, science books they've written. We'll even extend that to technology, engineering, and math, and whatever else floats our boat. And today, our guest is someone I've had the chance to speak with before about traveling to space. His name is Chris Impey. He's an astronomer. And today we're going to look in particular at this book, Beyond Our Future in Space, which just came out yesterday, hot off the press. Say hi, Chris, before I read your official bio.
Oh, hi, Joanne. It's good to be back on your show.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. Last time you joined me, we were talking about the MAVEN mission because they were getting ready to launch. And also, but you had written your book, Dreams of Other Worlds, which I don't have here to hold up, but that was a great book that was talking about unmanned space, or I guess unmanned space flight is not the PC term, right? We say robotic or whatever, right?
Unpersoned.
Unpersoned, right. So let me tell the audience about you. Just read your bio here. Chris Impey is a university distinguished professor at the University of Arizona and deputy head of the astronomy department. His research interests includes observational cosmology, quasars, and distant galaxies. He has written 160 research papers and two astronomy textbooks. He has won 11 teaching awards and has served as National Science Foundation Distinguished Teaching Scholar, a Phi Beta Kappa Visiting Scholar, and the Carnegie Council's Arizona Professor of the Year. He is former Vice President of the American Astronomical Society and Fellow of AAAS. He has published six popular science books, with two more in preparation and one novel. I think this is updated, right? These numbers are not exactly.
Yeah, the one in preparation is the one we're talking about, Beyond.
That's what I thought.
But you
That's what I thought.
always have on the go, so I'm sort of thinking about the next one, of course.
Right. And then you also got one of your books. So one of your books is a fiction, it's a novel. And I thought that was interesting. And we'll get back to that because I'm going to let Jeff talk, throw out the first question. But yeah, I have some questions about the kind of books you've written recently. So, Jeff, why don't you take it away? And welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Joanne. And it's nice that you're with us here today, Chris. I think I want to start with the big question that seems to me to come up every single time that we talk about travel into space. And it also, I think, is a major theme of your book, at least. The question is why? Why should we bother to go into space when there's so many problems on Earth to solve? And I've been hearing this ever since I was growing up in the Apollo days. Is it really worth doing beyond, saving humanity? And I noted that already, like by the seventh page of the book, you said our DNA tells the story of the profound human urge to explore. I like this answer. Do I get it right that you say we do this because it's what it is to be human?
I think, right, we do it because not all of us, but some of us can't help it, and it's built into us. So the thing that humans have done alone amongst all the animals of the planet who do migrate and search for food and travel large distances is we've done it without that as a driver. When we spread out of Africa, those migratory patterns is the Human Genographic Project out of the Smithsonian, National Geographic. It has these amazing maps, and it shows that we move out of Africa, across Asia, across the land bridge to the Americas, and all the way down to Patagonia in just a thousand, few hundreds of generations, which is a dramatic migratory surge across the planet. And we didn't have to, obviously. I always think in the middle of that journey, you were in Southern California, and it was probably pretty nice. So why didn't you just stay there, Did you go to Patagonia, where I've been there, and it's kind of crazy. So they've identified a variant of a gene, the DRD4 gene, an allele of that gene, which is correlated in the present-day society with risk-taking behavior and things like ADHD. And in historical work is also correlated with migratory patterns and how far humans traveled over the last millennia. So it seems that we have, not all of us, but some fraction of us have this risk-taking, exploring gene for its own sake. Obviously, if we all had it, it might be dysfunctional. We might survive. So it's a nice balance there in having that gene and having some people in the tribe who are willing to taste that strange food or go into that dark cave or climb over that mountain to see what's beyond it and risk their life to do so. So I guess we're just seeing versions of that. And when Elon Musk says he wants to die on Mars, he's clearly, I think, expressing that gene.
So when we need to do something like the Apollo program, how do we enlist the people who think that, you know, what's essential to being human is just hunting and gathering, and the rest, all the cultural trappings, are really unimportant? And I don't think they are. You don't think they are, but they think they are. Is there any hope, or do we just let the Elon Musks push ahead and drag everyone along?
Well, and most people don't have to and won't go along. So I think it's not it's a false dichotomy to say it's either or. Either we heal the planet or we explore space. I mean, we will hopefully do both, and we actually will not spend most of our resources, financial or human resources, on space travel. It's always going to be a niche thing. It has been so far with, what, less than 600 people have ever been in orbit. That's a pretty small club. And so I think, you know, some fraction of us will do it, and it's a worthy thing to do if it doesn't usurp your resources and distract you or deflect you from the big problems of the Earth. But also, being in space and learning how to live in space and in harsh environments is probably going to be informative about how to live on a planet that may not be as hospitable towards us as it is now in the future.
But I think your point is important, that probably historically even the number of people involved in exploration has been a small group of total people, and missions to, I don't know, sail across the Atlantic Ocean are expensive, but hardly a huge drain on resources anyway, so people should just get over it, perhaps.
Well, and the other thing, you alluded to the Apollo missions, and, you know, the other thing we're dealing with in thinking about space is the slightly strange history of space travel and the space program. It's a little anomalous because that our greatest, our most magnificent achievement in space, going to the moon, which is extraordinary. When you think that, you know, pull your smartphone out of your pocket and that is 100 times more powerful than the computer that got the astronauts to the moon, it's staggering how that project worked given the fairly primitive technology of the late 60s. It was a very anomalous, you know, geopolitical pissing contest between the two superpowers of the time that drove it completely. NASA had completely unsustainable budgets through the mid to late 60s that then plummeted after the was canceled. So that's sort of an anomaly. I mean, it told us we could do a very hard thing, and there's still only 12 people who have set foot on another world. So that's a very exclusive club. If the number of astronauts is an exclusive club, people who've set foot on another world, now that is a special club.
We talked, last year, I guess, to the guys who wrote the book Marketing the Moon, and they made the case that the interest that was shown by the public in the Apollo mission was only partly due to technological accomplishment or the romance of going into space, but that NASA was very savvy about marketing it for all sorts of reasons to appeal to people, and the fact that there was that whole geopolitical Cold War and all that going, it was a unique time, maybe.
It was, and there were some interesting, the whole thing was swirled together, the either-or, again, of going into space or looking after the planet. As we know, the pictures taken by Apollo 8 of the Earth looking back, suspended in space, you know, coincided with the burgeoning environmental movement in the sense of the pale blue dot and the fragility of the planet. That sort of cosmic awareness of that really stemmed from that one moment of looking back. And that's an invaluable. I don't know how you put a price tag on that awareness.
Yeah.
But as we talk about the public interest waned very quickly after the first moon landings. The last three Apollo missions were canceled, the budgets plummeted, and it was a turbulent time, people moved on, people got interested in other things very quickly.
Right. You can't talk about space travel from Earth without talking about the socio-political things that were going on, you know, wars and things like that. So you mentioned about the phone having more, as we all know, having more technology, more power, more abilities, capabilities than, you know, the computers that powered the Apollo mission. But something that hasn't changed are the dangers of space. So this is still probably our limiting factor.
Yes, it's not. It's a. Mm-hmm. It's not a place people were meant to be. And you know, zero gravity is hard enough for long periods of time. I guess the Russian cosmonaut, his record is 824 days, and he's still alive. You know, but there are serious health problems for people in zero gravity. Being in a Moon or a Mars environment with modest gravity, we don't know what the long-term effects of that are. And we know how to shelter. We know how to take just lunar or Martian soil and make slump block and harden a shelter or cover a bubble dome with enough insulation that you're going to be protected from cosmic rays and micrometeorites. So you can make a safe environment, but it's clearly not a natural place for us to be.
Right. So I don't even know where to begin, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, because your book, as Jeff said before we went on air, your book covered a lot of ground. Like, I was like every chapter going, oh, wow, yeah, that's right. You need to talk about this as well as that thing and the other thing. So looking at the book, maybe I'll ask it this way. What was the most challenging chapter for you to write? Like something you felt like, I'm really stepping outside what I normally talk about when you were writing this book.
Probably, I mean, you're in the life sciences, so for me it was more the biology or physiology aspects, you know, the medical and the health effects of space and what it does to the human body, or how we might, the more fascinating aspect, which I don't really get into in too much detail, of how humans might change if we lived off Earth for multiple generations. But to me that's fascinating, because I imagine in short order, I mean, I know we won't become a separate species for a very long time formally, but in short order, if we lived in 1/6 gravity and in this very different situation, we'd change physiologically within a lifetime and then within a few generations. And it's very interesting to think how quickly that would happen and what would happen. And then alongside that is this intense psychological evolution that comes from being separate, from being a colonist, from being in a small community, somewhat separated from the Earth, from being really remote from terrestrial concerns and your extended family, and that would have a profound effect. So these sort of physical, physiological, psychological, evolutionary changes, if we do space seriously as an activity, are fascinating, because I don't think you can fully predict all of them.
Right, and you even brought up in your book, and I thought it was funny, I saw you post on social media that Slate decided to focus on the part about that human beings would be having sex in space. So for some reason, Slate, you know, why not? Let's be sensational and grasp on. But your case was saying we're biological beings, and that's what biological beings do, and this is something to consider if we're going to have prolonged, you know, time in space, whether we set up a colony on a moon or on Mars, that this is important. And I think you made a really, you know, interesting observation in that way that, yeah, this is going to have to happen, because we're talking, it takes 9 months to get to Mars. And then once you're there and you're setting up, you're not leaving for a long time, if at all.
Well, and it's an antidote. You need an optimistic strain. We know about the Mars One concept, and you know, that's been deconstructed a fair bit. It turned out they didn't have 100,000 people apply, as they said they did. Their financial model, based on TV reality shows, is pretty flaky, and the engineering of what they're planning to do is just not very robust. But this whole idea of one-way trips to Mars and that many people willing to risk dying there, I mean, a much more optimistic attack is to just say, well, let's just make a viable colony. Let's just, you know, have people be born, live, and die there, and see what happens. And of course, if you're talking about a landmark event in human history, it would indeed be the first baby conceived in space or in zero gravity. Maybe it'll happen in a space station in the near future, and then born off Earth. That's a pretty remarkable event in human history.
But speaking of the, or recalling the wide range of things that you bring into the discussion, this was one of them. You talked about population genetics, evolution, and speciation. Why? Because if you send humans to a distant planet, you have to make sure you have a large enough group that it's a viable population. How big is that? But if you do have that, you're not going to have 100 times that, so you're likely to have an evolutionary bottleneck, and in a fairly short order, geologically speaking, you're going to start diverging from the home group on Earth. That's an interesting thought.
Right, because the people who are not really considering doing it themselves or their children or grandchildren just think, okay, well, astronauts are just like us, and people who might choose to go and live on Mars they're just like us. They're just going on a long trip, and maybe they'll die there. But this whole idea of an offshoot of the human tree that really then becomes distinct, and it happens on a very rapid time scale. I mean, we've been anatomically modern for, well, at least 50,000 years, and that's, you know, we could face the possibility of in 1,000 years having a new little green shoot of the human tree that is fairly distinct in many ways. And then what allegiance would they have to us? I mean, how connected would they feel to the planet at some point? I like the science fiction in those, and you know, the Kim Stanley Robinson's Red, Green, Blue Mars trilogy is great on what will happen if we try and terraform Mars and have colonists there, and how will they view, you know, their relationship to the Earth and the people left behind.
And the greens and the reds, and then that was why you started talking about what turned out to be another interesting topic of who might own what, who doesn't own interplanetary or other moons and things right now, because it's taken care of by treaty, but if people go there, they'll say they do it, and we have a guy who's already selling parts of the moon, and maybe he can do that. people are going to go there, and stuff's going to happen.
So that's another strain of the adventurers, are the ones who are driven by a purely economic motive, you know. It's happened in human exploration of the Earth. You know, there's a lot of land out there, and I want to get a bunch of land for myself so I can grow my own things or build a factory or do what I want to do. The Outer Space Treaty, it's not clear how enforceable it is, and it doesn't leave a kind of interesting loophole as far as individual property rights that hasn't been tested in any, you know, world court. So, I think the issue really is just enforcement rather than what the law actually says or doesn't say.
Yeah, so we'll have to ship a few lawyers out to Mars to make sure they're there to drop the papers.
Their space law is actually, I sort of Googled it, and it's interesting. It's a niche that's growing significantly. It's obviously not a huge niche. Just like there are lawyers to deal with cryonics, you know, there are lawyers who will manage your estate if you think you're going to be resuscitated after being cryonically frozen for a millennium, and deal with that vast amount of interest you made on your investments.
while you're asleep, right? So, I felt like your book, it covered so much, but I thought it was great because it's like one-stop shop. What's it going to take to go to this space, right? But when you talked about things that are often brought up in sci-fi, and you reference many sci-fi books, so I was thinking, as I'm listening to about cryonics and about embryos going to space to recolonize, did you happen to see Interstellar?
Yes.
And what did you think of that? It's out on DVD as of like last week or something.
I'm sort of a fan. I sort of dropped out of the habit of trying to be too... I don't see films like that with colleagues. You know, I see it with my family. And picky about it. Unless they're just trampling the science badly, I just want to enjoy it. And if it's artistically and creatively well done, I just usually have a good time and, you know, suspend judgment a few places if needed. So I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty fun. I was a little perplexed at Anne Hathaway's endless supply of red lipstick on this endless journey, but, you know. but otherwise, I thought, okay, you know, I was probably more, because I'm not a cosmologist. I'm not, you know, I'm thinking, well, I have to take what they're saying about wormholes and all sort of at the value they're presenting it and check later or read someone else. This is analysis if I really care. So I'm at the point where I just have to sit back and enjoy it. The only thing I thought, the agriculture on Earth, I was like, really? Is that really what's happening? But that's the worldview I bring. So your book also has not just you referencing, you know, other sci-fi and maybe explaining things that come up in sci-fi, but you were also... you also included sort of some fictional scenarios, mm-hmm. just interspersed there, here and there, and I thought that was interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I just wanted more than a device, I just wanted to get a different flavor. I mean, I write nonfiction all the time, and I've had a little foray into science fiction, but even in a standard popular science book, I like the idea of, you know, transporting the reader a little bit into a scenario or a hypothetical situation, or just letting their imagination run free a little more. And these little vignettes were just one way of doing it.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting because I don't think, well, we certainly haven't interviewed anyone who's done that before. Jeff, to your knowledge, is that the case? I think Chris is the first.
I think it's the first time we've sort of barely touched a little bit on a fictional element, yeah.
I mean, Carl Sagan is the archetype of someone who wrote mm-hmm. popular science and science fiction and, you know, could move undoubtedly in any format seamlessly between the two.
Yeah, and I think we'll be talking to more authors of fiction who also have many, many things to contribute.
So... let me ask, as far as your agent, your publisher goes, I remember I spoke one time to Reza Aslan, not on the show, but I went to a book reading of his, and he's a geopolitical analyst, particularly about Islam, and he wrote two books about Islam and the political issues we have, America has with this, but he said he wants to write fiction, but he is being, you know, the publisher's like, no, write one more nonfiction before we let you do that. You know, it's just, is it true then they see like, okay, this formula is working well, don't mess with that? So did you have any resistance when you wrote your fiction book?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So my experience is similar. I basically went rogue when I did that. So my agent said the same thing. She said, you do popular science. You know, she's a young Indian woman, very good at what she does. She works for the same agency that the senior partner of whom was Carl Sagan's agent, and so I knew she had a good pedigree. But, yeah, she said, stick to your last, you know, you make anvils, so make some more anvils. So I just had to take out some time and do it myself, and I learned how to self-publish. And that was a learning curve. I just wanted to experience that. And sometimes the box, it's not a very constraining box to write a popular science or fiction, a nonfiction science, but it is still somewhat constraining. So I was just happy to venture out that into the wild side for a little while. I don't think I'm going to live there, but I may, you know, have another venture out there. I don't know.
For a brief digression, maybe. It won't be long, Joanne. About publishers and agents, and we like to investigate. One of the things that keeps coming up in the book is the rocket equation, because it has historical significance and it has obvious relevance as a constraint to many of the things that you're talking about. And the first time I read about it, it's like, okay, why was it your choice or was it your agent's choice or the publisher's choice not to print an equation?
Oh, I think that's a good question, but I think it was just a tacit agreement that...
just happened.
That it was, I also view it as a challenge as a scientist who has to teach non-science students, you know, and we do, you know, algebra and geometry and simple math in the class, but sometimes it's a challenge to teach a concept in words, you know, can you choose the words carefully enough that it's fully understood in words? So rather than a bailout, sometimes I view that as a challenge, an interesting challenge. If you can concretely describe something that is intrinsically mathematical without the math.
Okay, Joanne. Oh. I told you it was brief.
No, that's okay. In fact, I did see you did, though, without the equations, you did still manage to put a lot of graphs and images in here, which we don't often see. But, you know, what I thought of it as was something along the lines of, let's say you were reading a, reading a newspaper article, you know, and there would be interrupted every once in a while with a graphic or an infographic or something or a simple graph that it highlights and explains. And I thought that the number of graphs actually was sort of a surprise to me because we don't, so something like this, we don't see this very often. In science books, so I thought that's pretty brave, and I'm glad your publisher actually let you do this.
Well, and it's also a little expedient, because in with science books, you can either have the sort of full-color coffee table route, expensive and only possible sometimes in some arenas, or, you know, if you're just going with the flow of the fact that you have a black-and-white art program, then you can do graphs. I mean, bar charts and graphs and so on actually work quite well.
Do non-technical readers freak out less over graphs than they would equations, do you think?
Yeah, I think, well, because it's rife, you know, the McPaper, USA Today, or whatever, you know, will have bar charts and graphs and so on the front page. But they've sort of permeated the popular culture, you know, used in kind of amazingly trite and trivial topics, you know, that you present the information graphically when you think, why would anyone care about that information at all? But, so people are using,
A big part of what you talked about was very interesting and is part of a bigger picture, is commercial attempts to get into space. And I was thinking that a couple summers ago we talked to Buzz Aldrin, just to drop names, about his book Mission to Mars. And comparing that to what you were talking about together, it seemed to me that his project, which his suggestions for how to go about doing something, had a lot to speak for it. He was looking for something with vision, something that would animate the American public, something that would be new for NASA to do and for Americans to learn, and all sorts of things. But his vision, his picture sort of necessarily seemed to include NASA as the main component, the government doing this project. And I don't think that resonates really with your picture of how things are really going to go via commercialization that you compared to the growth of the internet and things like, you make a case that we're in a period where it's commercial interests that are going to take over now and propel the project, which would lead to different things probably, although Mars is an obvious target. But so is that the right picture, that the commercialization of some sort is probably about to take over?
I mean, it's tricky on the cusp of something that's just emerging to confidently say it's just going to roar ahead. But I was making that case, I guess, that indeed analogizing to the internet, that where we are now is roughly the same as 1995 for the internet, when it emerged from being an entity. The word internet dates from 1995, and Amazon was founded then, and you know, nobody could place a bet on these now titanic companies that they would grow to what they would be now. And then there were some like Yahoo and Netscape that didn't do so well. So picking winners and losers is hard, but projecting the activity, I think, is fairly reliable, just because the economic projections, just start with the foundation stone of satellites. The satellite industry is extremely robust, and it has this huge growing wing, which is involved in remote sensing the Earth for various way. So I'm going to just pick a very recent example, because it's a good example of how the bar is lower. People are now using these CubeSats, or these Dove imaging telescopes, these miniaturized satellite platforms, and bundling them together, and the bar is really low, so student groups and universities can do it. And they're doing a lot of exciting science that way. I mean, sending just fleets of these microsatellites up, and it doesn't matter if a few don't work and some of them burn up, and that's your cell phone technology in orbit and doing very interesting things. Bar set very low for that, and so that's busting the whole Leviathan model of telecommunications and satellites in space, and that's happening right now in ways that we don't probably appreciate. So that's one area, the satellite industry, and it has a lot of importance. That's another way of getting around this dichotomy, with the false dichotomy, I think, between doing the space thing or looking after the Earth. We're going to use the space thing to look after the Earth and to look out for the Earth and to measure the Earth and diagnose what's going on at a level that we've never been able to do before. And then there's the tourism recreation part and the sex part and those things that, you know, Robert Bigelow with his motels in space and so on. And, you know, it's a multi-tiered model. There'll be a super rich, just as there is with vacation travel. There'll be, you know, the equivalent of the people who have their own Bahama island that they go and vacation on, and the people that jam thousands strong onto a cruise ship and go to the Bahamas. And it'll be the same thing for recreation in space. But I think the economics are pretty robust. I did a little poll in my class, the class I'm teaching right now, a few weeks ago, and just projected for millennials. I have 150, so in my class, the statistics are pretty good. They were asked, although they had, using clickers so they could get real data, how much they would spend on a once-in-a-lifetime, three-day orbital vacation, assuming it's not super dangerous. Maybe not as safe as air flight, but, you know, it's not. They're not likely to die. And then I just ran out the model, and it projects for millennials alone, that cohort, to $30 to $40 billion a year industry. That's substantial. And so even if that's a little wrong, it's not wrong by an order of magnitude. So that, I think that's all just in its early stages. And there'll be exploration as part of that too, because some of the commercial entities, and especially the billionaires behind them, they're of course driven by the profit motive. They're entrepreneurs, they're business people. But some of them, are in it for more interesting reasons and slightly more pure reasons, if you like. And so they might, like I think I gave as an example, I wouldn't be at all surprised if Amazon or one of these big companies dusts off NASA's plan to go back to Titan and look for life there and just funds it and does it as a commercial venture. And that's pure exploration, that's pure science that wasn't going to get done otherwise, because NASA can only afford one big thing at a time.
Right.
And there can be hidden resources. I hadn't been aware, but just providing launch vehicles for satellites is big business, right?
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of money in it.
Yeah.
And that's strictly commercial at this point.
It's a completely reliable business. I mean, the business model is really robust. That is a steadily to 6 to 8% a year industry, growing 6 to 8% a year. And that's in the traditional model of large, multi-purpose, expensive satellites. The low end is nanosat, microsat world has barely started to, I mean, there were only about 140 CubeSats launched last year, which is more than all the previous years, so it's growing pretty fast, but nobody knows how that's going to play out 10 years from now. And of course, the exploring, so that part of the miniaturization part of this projection will have its own exploration aspect, because you can put your solar sail on a nanosat and start to do some interesting things in the solar system, and then it won't cost as much as Cassini sending $1 billion Cassini out there. So there's going to be low cost solar system exploration, and that's interesting too.
Yeah, I thought that was a fascinating part of the book, just to talk about, everything's miniaturized, and yeah, it wouldn't take much power to get things to be propelling through the great beyond there. I was also interested in that you did a pretty good job taking apart, I guess, and examining the different countries who are now involved in space exploration. China, Japan, India, they just sent orbiting around Mars, right? And they did that pretty well, and that stands out. You didn't talk about that one so much in the book, but you talked about China and Japan.
Right, and the cipher, they're not completely a cipher, but the cipher is China because they're putting so much into it. They're growing their space program at the rate their economy is growing compared to NASA's flatline or stagnant budget. That gets you an awful lot of progress. And they're not, some people denigrate the Chinese for just sort of picking apart our technology and copying it and improving it a little. And they've done their share of that in space, but they've got their own set of rocket scientists and innovators and technologists, and they're building things ground up, and they're a legitimate big player, and their program is extremely ambitious. I mean, they're talking both moon base, Mars base. They could have their own space station at a time 7 or 8 years from now where the ISS is deorbited and burned up and we don't have one. That's going to get people's attention, and I don't want to see particularly another geopolitically inclined and tense space race with the Chinese to echo the one we had with the Russians, but it could happen.
Yeah, so if they set up a colony on the moon, we might wonder, hey, why aren't we setting up a colony on the moon?
India and China, as emergent countries of huge population and huge human resource and financial resource, yes, there is some issue of projection of power. For the Chinese, absolutely, they're not shy about saying that. And so I don't think the United States will want to cede the ground to the Chinese of either an orbital capability like a space station where we didn't have one, or a moon base where we didn't have a footprint on the moon, just as with Antarctic, the thing sort of very quickly shook out that everyone had to have their footprint there and their research station there, or to make it, so that people didn't get too agitated. And then the militarization part is, nobody wants to think about it, but again, the enforcement of the Outer Space Treaty, nobody knows how that would work. And I know the technology is sufficient that the Chinese absolutely could not put any modest scale nuke into space without us knowing. There's just simply no way they could do that without us knowing. That doesn't actually mean they might never do it. I mean, just if things go badly, you never know how things are going. We're not getting on that well with the Russians, but we don't worry about them eating our lunch in space because their technology is 50 years old and decaying. But with the Chinese, there's an issue there.
When talking about the exploration, you made a good case that the Chinese, perhaps because of their central style of government or something, are able to approach things long-term and strategically. And that seems something that's just not possible in the U.S. right now. Is there a way to get back? Is there a way to implement anything strategic, or do we just have to do it locally, a step at a time?
That's a good point, and it's a great sort of compare and contrast situation. Yes, the Chinese have had not all the strategic documents of how they view space are available to us. So some are leaked and some we can guess. But yes, they've been playing out 10 and 20-year timelines on their space program and developing in-house talent. And again, some of their capabilities that they'll have 10 years from now, we really don't know because they're emerging out of the hands of young professionals in their space program who don't travel to the West. So they are taking the long view, and we absolutely don't. I mean, just look at the chopping and changing of the heavy launch capability, the ups and downs of Constellation. Now it's a space launch system. Look at the Moon, Mars, and beyond, ups and downs for 10 or 15 years. It's it's an election cycle level of planning for NASA. The NASA administrator is a quasi-political appointment, and it has to be very sensitive to how Congress thinks and what the administration wants to do or doesn't want to do. It's not a great climate for developing any strategic vision, and so it's almost, I feel a little unfair when NASA keeps getting dinged on that, as if it's not their employees or their leadership. I mean, they may not have had always the very best leadership, and they may indeed have had some brain drain and some loss of talent to Silicon Valley over the decades, but there's some super smart, super clever, super long-term thinking people there, and I've met them. So I think some of the knocks on NASA are a little unfair.
or should they work for the entrepreneurs? Is the entrepreneurial vision the place where we should look here for our long-term thinking?
Yes, now? It's a mixed model, and they are partnering. So they're not partnering particularly with the very big players, with Jeff Bezos, say. Nobody really knows what he's going to do anyway. He's too secretive to work with NASA. NASA would have to reveal a lot of information. But they're playing. They're working with smaller companies. Just in the last week or so, there's this program where NASA was dishing out, you know, multi-million-dollar grants, but not huge ones, to a dozen or more private sector companies, young, nimble startup companies on propulsion technology, getting back to ion drives and these sort of very efficient forms of space propulsion. They're not very high impulse, so they're not as good as a beautiful chemical rocket, but for doing solar system exploration, they're extremely good. And NASA's partnering with them. They're obviously dishing out multi-billion dollar contracts to SpaceX and Orbital Sciences, but basically up and down the scale, NASA is doing a lot of partnering. I mean, I think they're very open to it.
So this suggests that a good possible future for NASA that frequently shows up in our government model of NASA as a management organization that helps organize or oversee, or that's even too controlling, but helps keep parts bigger, smaller parts into a bigger whole somehow.
And also just their vast technical expertise, the institutional memory and aggregate expertise of their engineers is simply phenomenal. You know, they've tested and worked on the various propulsion technologies. They've had little lab setups running for decades that can take the Martian or lunar soil and get oxygen for rocket fuel and to breathe and water out of it and make slump walk to build a habitat. Some of these are technologies that are not, you know, they're not rocket science, so to speak. They're not dreamy technologies. And NASA just has a lot of expertise in it. And even the visionary stuff. NASA's resuscitated the 100-year Starship concept and have started doing meetings every year on that, where they, you know, that does have its sort of wide-eyed, wild-eyed aspect, because these are the people that are trying to do interstellar travel. But most of the people at these meetings are engineers. You know, they're not like visionary guru types or science fiction writers. They're engineers.
And then another thing that keeps coming up is the asteroid mining. So that's something being looked at by entrepreneurs, but also NASA.
And that one is the one I'm the most skeptical of. Not that it's impossible physically to lasso an asteroid and bring it Earth orbit and then harvest it, but the economic model for that I think is far less secure than the space tourism economic model. People are, and I don't think that people are going to do it, so I think it will happen maybe in 2 decades or 3 decades, but people are going to lose their shirts. I mean, there are some people that are going to really take a bath on that one, because the cost of extraction and transportation are severe. And then, of course, you've got the more delicate economic issue of how do you stop the bottom dropping out of the market of your rare earths and your precious metals now that you're sitting on a huge, you know, the Bunker brothers learned this with silver in the 1970s or 80s, that cornering the market in something is a tricky thing to do. Yeah, they're going to do it, but I think most of the papers I've seen written on it are somewhat idealistic, and they don't seem to... Hard-nosed economists haven't weighed in on this one yet. Although I noticed Paul Krugman wrote this classic paper in the 60s on interstellar commerce. Actually, it was part of what made his reputation. I mean, you know, I'm sure he was an undergraduate, actually. That's kind of interesting that Nobel Prize-winning economist actually did his senior thesis on interstellar commerce.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that. You are a cosmologist, and so if you were to give advice to someone who wanted to write some books like you have been doing, what would that be? So sort of explain a little bit about your philosophy, not as a step-by-step let's copy Chris Impey, but you have written a lot of books. So you've gathered a lot of wisdom over the years. So what kind of hints and tips would you say to someone who's trying to communicate science to the general public?
The main thing I would say is, you know, if you want to be a writer, you have to write. And if you're a scientist and you want to be a writer, that's hard because the working life does not really permit long stretches of time uninterrupted. I mean, my MO is to get up at 5 in the morning and get an hour or so, and I don't do it every day, and then maybe half a day on a weekend day. The work life doesn't really let you write. You can do science and admin and teach and all that kind of stuff in little bursts and multiplex, but you can't write that way. So the first thing is you're going to probably have to restructure your life in a fairly hard-nosed way to let there be space into which you can breathe and write. The second thing is, I think anyone writing, and it's true for me and everyone I talked to when I started, you just have to be writing all sorts of things. You know, write a blog, write popular articles. Even if you can't get them published, just learn how to write short form science. Read a lot of good writers, or read the best writers. I mean, science fiction or popular science, whoever. Most writers, a writer who doesn't read is probably not as good a writer as a writer who does read. And to experiment with those different forms. Writing a book is scary, it's intimidating, and it's actually extremely hard. You know, I'm just always in the rearview mirror. I wonder, why did I do that? You know, because that was really hard. So it's not that you have to work up to it, but you do have to be writing in different forms because you have to be able to make arguments quickly and succinctly. And then as far as a book goes, it's got to grab you. I mean, you've got to wait till something just sort of hits you upside the head and grabs you, and then not really be dissuaded by, you know, popular opinion or, I mean, there are market forces. Obviously, you can't move into a heavily saturated field, and there are trends in popular science writing and waves of books that come out just like there are movies, you know. So you don't want to be writing, you know, your zombie cosmology book in a year when a lot of zombie cosmology books just came out. So we have to pay attention to that. I think writing a big, you know, the big form, writing a popular science book is challenging and rewarding just because you get to explore the fullness of the subject. You can give the history. You can talk about the people who do it. You can juice it up with, you know, hopefully very current and topical research. And in fact, popular science books and all the people in my arena, editors and agents, etc., you know, tell you, no, the people, your audience are generally knowledgeable about science. People who read popular science books read more than one or two a year. They tend to read 6, 8, 10 a year. And so they pretty much know what's going on. So you can't sort of give them some little primer on cosmology as if they were a biologist who'd never paid attention to astronomy. No, they're probably people who are pretty well read about science in general. And so you have to tell them something new, something they don't know, something interesting, or give them insights or layers of the analysis or discussion that they wouldn't have encountered. So that's challenging, but I mean, it's definitely doable. And I do feel, although, you know, the world still needs more good science disseminated in all the various media available, books, articles, podcasts, online, etc. I mean, there's too much science illiteracy out there. I do research on that, so I know the numbers. They're not very encouraging. So, you know, it's a crusade at some level.
So Chris, well, he can't be the only person who is telling everybody about outer space.
And I'm not, and there's I like the fact that I run into fellow who compare notes and commiserate over the brutality of writing. I went to sounds a little random, but in Prague there's the Kafka Museum. It's a great museum, a beautiful city, of course. And there's a part of the Kafka Museum that has his notebooks and so on. He was a student there. He just got a smothering government job in a bureaucracy, and he was thwarted, and writing was his only outlet. And there was a notebook he wrote, and there's one agonized entry that's highlighted in the museum. Just impossible to write. Impossible not to write. You know?
Jeff does some writing, more so than I do, so I think he's laughing knowingly.
Yeah.
That made me feel better to know that the young Kafka was agonizing in the same way.
Yeah. And he's right. We could tell, I think, your intended audience, your philosophy, this is just a commendable thing to point out, and your publisher, because you have very good notes in this book, I think. They were very interesting and useful notes. And we always appreciate that here at Read Science.
But I'll tell you one final thought I had on that. I mean, part of the reason I went rogue and wrote a science fiction book was I was feeling a little, siloed, and universities are very sensitive to being siloed. We don't talk to our philosophy or humanities colleagues unless we run into each other across campus. So you're in your little tribe and your niche. And, the messaging I get from publishers and agents and so on is, you do this thing, this is the thing you know how to do and you've done it before, and you have an audience and this audience likes this thing. And actually what I was reaching for when I wrote a novel, and I consider it a failed, a well-intentioned and failed experiment, but an interesting experiment, that's the best thing about it, is that I wanted to write fiction where there was a lot of science in it and not in a kind of clunky or obtrusive or didactic or preachy way. I was wanting to actually, rather than take a popular science approach and add a fictive element, as with these vignettes that we were talking about a while ago, I wanted to go to the other side of take a fictional approach and inject enough real science, honest science, that you would barely notice that you were actually reading about science, because it was a story and it was about people and it was happening and it was a novel. It wasn't a book that had felt worthy or felt like you were eating your vegetables.
We talked earlier about the large online courses that you're teaching, and when you were talking about CubeSats earlier, so it made me think, how soon do you think it would be that one of your courses launch your first CubeSat mission?
Oh, well, that would be nice. I would have to come up with a good concept. But it's an incredible way to do citizen science. So I think that's the way it might happen. I'd have to get together with some partners on that.
Because that's quite possible now with these lines coming down, this technology coming up, prices changing. That's something that you could actually think about doing in a practical way, right?
One of these consortia that just doing their thing right now are using these low-cost imagers, the Dove technology, as they call it, and they're putting up hundreds of these and acknowledging that some will die, some won't work, and so on. And they're putting up a big enough network, and the imaging, of course, is not as good as the spy satellites. It's about a meter-scale imaging. But they're putting up enough to be able to image every place on the Earth every couple of days. And that opens up some very interesting possibilities of monitoring things. And I mean, that's a capability we've never had. And commercial satellites are unlikely to provide it. So it's an amazing niche.
There's a big philosophical change that you just make me realize. When we were doing our space shuttle experiment, and everything you want to think about doing costs millions of dollars, and every opportunity is seen as this is the one opportunity, and it has to work right, and it has to be redundant, and it can't be a single point. All of that picture changes about what you can do and how you can do it if you can start to think of things as expendable, right?
Mm-hmm. And that's probably the biggest, we were talking about NASA and partnerships commercially, that's probably the biggest resistant. It's not that they're, stubbornly resistant against it, but that's the biggest cultural change has been hard for NASA to accommodate. I mean, they've had so much success with these expensive multi-purpose missions, the multi-billion-dollar missions, whether it's Hubble Space Telescope or Cassini, and even the Mars rovers, even the little rovers, in the end, it's $1 billion. So, these are expensive. You could send a little cloud of nanobots to Mars for a small fraction of the cost of one of those rovers, and a vehicle launched with a solar sail. So that's something you could do now. So I think it has been hard for NASA to get around the history of how they do projects and missions, and they're doing it through partnerships. I think they're just learning through these partnerships and through letting letting people use their launch capability, letting them use their space and their rockets to launch all these little nimble, expendable things that may or may not work. And I'm sure the engineers wince at that, because the spec on the spec on electronics you send into, you know, Intel and all the chip makers have always had their special runs to make hardware for NASA or for the military, you know, because they have to survive cosmic rays and micrometeorite impacts and so on, and they have to have some durability spec that's way beyond consumer electronics. And this new sector is just saying, no, you know, everything we need is in a smartphone. You know, all the sensors that anyone might want to put in orbit are already there in various plugins to your smartphone, so let's just put that in orbit. And it's stunningly obvious and simple once you say it, but NASA have taken a while to think, oh, I guess that's not a bad idea.
Yeah, I think it's ingenious. Your book, we don't have time to talk about all the different things in your book, but your book also talked about sort of virtual reality to space. You send something out there that then we're here, you know, interacting with space, but not really.
Yeah, and the issue there is latency. So it's already an issue for the rovers and things that we control on remote. In remote locations, when you have signal travel times that are 20, 30 minutes for, say, like Mars, or hours for outer solar system, that definitely becomes an issue. But this sort of telepresence idea is definitely going to, it's going to get around that problem of, you know, sending people always where people are expensive and very hard to, you know, protect and expensive to protect. Or robots. Again, it becomes a false dichotomy if you think it has to either be a nanobot or a person, and those are such different propositions. Well, maybe you sort of get elements of both with telepresence.
Yeah, I thought that was the most enlightening thing I read in your book, because, of course, being one of those people who read more than 6 to 8 books a year, I'd be like, oh, exoplanets. Yeah, Lee Billings talked about that in this book. And, you know, so I'm looking at different parts of the book going, oh, yeah, I've read. Mm-hmm. So this felt familiar, and it was nice, you know, to see it all tied together. Like, these are all the things we need to consider. I was so happy when I like to read the blurbs on the back of the books. I saw Dava Sobel really liked your book, and I was like, because I like her.
Yeah, she's fun. I was I had a very fun time in Princeton. I was on sabbatical a couple of years ago, and I did a science writing workshop for the university for their writing students. And I, you know, because I was on the East Coast where I don't live, I managed to get Alan Lightman and Dava Sobel and Diane Ackerman and Dan Levin. I got some of my favorite Mike Lemonick. I got some of my favorite people from nearby to come and workshop and we got to hang out, and Dave was a lot of fun.
I would have loved that workshop.
And actually, the most fun event was I had Dave and Diane Ackerman, they're great personal friends.
Oh, wow.
And I said, hey, you guys should just do an evening on stage, you know, just talk. We chairs. And we said that the room filled. It was one of the beautiful venues in Rockefeller Hall, I think, in Princeton, just a beautiful place. And they did. They just, you know, I was the MC, but I was completely superfluous. They just sat in those armchairs, and they just talked about science and writing and life and art and love, and it was amazing. I mean, and the audience were just riveted, so that was a lot of fun.
That would have been great.
One more quick question. This may be my last. When we're comparing the internet and space entrepreneurship, when is someone going to figure out how to use sex to sell space?
To sell space?
Well, we believe that sex is what makes the internet go in large part. You know, we can really fund space exploration if someone, and maybe it's the orbiting hotel that's going to do it. But.
Right. As Bigelow is Mr. Motel 8, I guess, and he's the one with the most mature plans for hotels in space. It's going to happen, and probably it's going to happen in part because it's an unregulated environment. And, I mean, and that's really not, you know, I don't want to end on this, but I mean, sex slaves, and you don't want to think about the bad stuff that could happen. I mean, astronomer, I worry more about the garish advertising in space messing up my nice, dark sky. That's the thing that astronomers get agitated about when they think of commercial entities.
Right.
You know, just, you know, 1,000-kilometer neon signs, please. No.
Well, the other thing we could do is send Kate Upton up there because she's been to Antarctica and she's been on the Vomit Comet for Sports Illustrated. So I guess, you know, that's the next thing we do, Jeff.
Yeah. Well, I bet Joanne can think of another positive question to ask. She always is.
Well, we are right at the top of the hour, and you mentioning your author, some of your favorite authors that you were able to work with, sort of gives me an idea of the kind of books you read. But you must read a lot, because it would seem you're reading science fiction and science from all different genres. So, what are you reading now? And then we'll sort of end on that.
I'm going back and I'm catching up with some of the hard science fiction that I missed in the past. But also I like to read. I'm actually rereading the book The Fatal Shore about the Australians, how the Australia was populated by British convicts and all the turmoil in Britain. So I read historical books because I was in Australia last year for 6 weeks and I got a little intrigued by their unusual history, sort of mirrors American history in a certain way, but not exactly. So that's the book I've just waited. It's a big 700-page book. So it's
right. Cool. Would you care to name a few names?
It's a physical book. It's not a Kindle. So I do still have physical books around.
Of your hard science fiction authors, would you care to name a few names? I can always use some new ones.
Let's see. I'm not talking about recently. I consider him hard science, but Kim Stanley Robinson is one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
And just because he puts the social, societal, cultural element in play, and the science is still really well done. So I'm still working my way through some of his earlier stuff. That's sort of what happens. I find an author, one of their more recent books,
mm-hmm.
and then I have to work back through their oeuvre to catch up with things they were writing about over time.
Right, because science fiction writers tend to write a lot.
I know they're scarily prolific. I've tried to sit down with someone and ask them how on earth do they manage that? You know, writing a trilogy or a whatever the word for writing 15 books about universe out there. How do you do that?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So, well, we're at the end of an hour, and it's gone by very quickly, and it's been such a pleasure to have you again, Chris. And, you know, you keep writing books, we'll keep inviting you back.
Okay, so. That's all the motivation I need. Well, thanks.
Yeah.
The only one, right? So, Chris, thank you, and Jeff, as always, thank you, and thank you to our audience for tuning in, and be sure to get a copy of the book Beyond, Our Future in Space by Chris Impey, which just came out yesterday, and yep, Jeff is pointing to it because mine fell on the floor, so, all right, thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Jeff and Joanne, it's a pleasure.
Thanks, Chris.
Bye.
Bye.